From the Sky News Centre at 5, Labour leader Ed Miliband's appointed his first shadow cabinet. Yvette Cooper has been named as shadow foreign secretary, while her husband Ed Balls has got the job of shadow home secretary. Both lost out on the role of shadow chancellor to Alan Johnson, despite being hotly tipped for the job. Ms Cooper wouldn't say whether she was disappointed.
I've got such a great job to do. I mean, it's a huge honour to do this job. So, and I think Alan Johnson will be a great shadow chancellor as well. I think the important thing is we're going to be working as a team, all of us, and I think it'll be a very united team around Ed Miliband's leadership.
Officials say the volume of red toxic sludge sweeping through Hungary is almost as large as the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. A seventh person is now reported to have died as a result of a reservoir at a metals refining plant bursting on Tuesday. Authorities say pH levels in the River Danube are normal, but Greenpeace say there are high levels of pollution. A new merger deals to create the UK's biggest high street travel agency. The tie-up between Thomas Cook and the Cooperative Group will create a network of over 1,200 branches. Hundreds of job losses are expected. 57 NHS patients had surgery on the wrong part of their body last year. Figures have been released by the National Patient Safety Agency highlighting the errors. The government's pledge there should never be called what's called wrong site surgery. In football, it's Euro 2012 qualifying action for the home nations tonight. Scotland are top of their group going into their game with the Czech Republic. Manager Craig Levine says the Czechs could be low on confidence.
You know, the first three games, I'm pretty sure they were hoping to chalk up 9 points. Well, they've lost the first game to Lithuania.
Wales search for their opening point against Bulgaria. Northern Ireland have a 100% record going into their game with Italy, and the Republic of Ireland host Russia. And hundreds of people have lined the quayside at Southampton to welcome Cunard's new 92,000-ton liner. Queen Elizabeth has been built in Italy at a cost of £400 million. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
This is a public service announcement.
Non-chart and experimental music can be mentally challenging. If you're of a fragile disposition, please do not listen to our John Peel Day. BCFM's John Peel Day, Monday the 11th of October, 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. Keeping it real, keeping it Peel.
BCFM's John Peel Day, Monday the 11th of October, 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. Keeping it real, keeping it Peel.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and on the week that Bristol Lib Dem council leader Barbara Jenk announced the biggest cuts in the city's history, and yes, we have invited Barbara on the show 5 times without success so far, my guest is Labour MP this week for Bristol East, that's Kerry McCarthy. And old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Evening Post reported yesterday that we have at least 40 men and women rough sleeping on the nooks and crannies of Bristol city centre. It's getting colder every night and we're facing a winter of benefit cuts and job losses. Isn't our wealthy society able to house people anymore? If the mortgage company tells you to get out, if the recession makes you a squatter in your own home, what are your rights? And if the money dries up, how do you feed your family? If you hit the bottom, is it possible to bounce back up again? And Avon and Somerset Police tell us why they spent thousands of pounds of public money sending an armed response unit, CID, dog units and the helicopter to evict squatters for burglary and then drop the charges. Ben Ritchie from Bristol Squatter Network BAM and Paul Hazelden from the Wild Goose Free Cafe on City Road will be here to tell it like it is. That's in the second hour. Well, on to our review of the week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Highs of 16 degrees Celsius the weekend, fairly dry with some sunny spells, also pretty windy. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius again, fairly dry and sunny week, possibly again windy. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of October, highs right down to 13 Celsius, sunny on Saturday but wet on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, trying to introduce out this week's guests now. With me is Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy. Welcome to Drive Time, Kerry.
Hello.
Now, first of all, you are the Labour MP for Bristol East, but what did you do before you became an MP?
Most of the time I was a lawyer. I sort of did various things. So I worked in the legal profession, ranging from doing legal aid work, sort of very much high street, family law, criminal law, personal injury work, to actually doing sort of quite complex corporate law. And then I worked for a few more sort of political organisations before I got elected.
So what drew you into politics after being a lawyer?
Well, I'd always been interested in politics. I'd sort of studied politics, you know, my degree was in Russian and politics. And then it was really the 92, you know, so I was interested in it from a sort of theoretical point of view and following what was going on. But I really became active after the 92 election defeat because, you know, I suddenly, it sort of dawned on me that it was one thing sort of sitting there ranting at the television and being appalled by what was going on around me, but actually I had to sort of get involved and be out there campaigning and knocking on doors and all that sort of stuff as well.
So why the Labour Party though? Why not the Lib Dems? Why not the Conservatives? Why not the Greens?
Well, I would have thought that it was pretty obvious why not at least one of them. I mean, you know, I grew up during the 1980s and saw what Margaret Thatcher was doing to this country. And, you know, that whole sort of philosophy of individual selfishness and, you know, leaving people to fend for themselves and some of the things that, you know, I think very much back on the political agenda now. I have to say, yeah, the Liberal Democrats didn't really register. Well, I suppose they were the SDP in those days. They didn't really register with me. But I think the main difference between the Labour Party and the Conservatives and Lib Dems, and this is partly why the Lib Dems are able to work in coalition with them, is they are based on very much about the individual and individual rights and individual freedoms, which sometimes then can be translated as, you know, the freedom to ride roughshod over everyone else. Whereas Labour's the only party that really has that strong belief in the collective and the, you know, the collective good and people working together and that sense of sort of solidarity. And, you know, that to me was always, you know, coming from, I guess, a large family and from a sort of community where I sort of felt community ties were important. That was that idea that you look after other people in your family, in your neighbourhood, in your city or whatever, was just fundamental to what I believe politically.
Now, I think what you said about ranting at the television or at the radio or whatever is something that's very familiar to people. What would you say is the best thing to do if you've got something you're really frustrated with? On what occasions can an MP actually help, and how do you actually do that as an MP?
Well, it's partly, you know, I mean, as an MP, I would get involved with a whole range of issues from, you know, people wanting holes in their roads fixed, which is, you know, predominantly a council matter. But, you know, if people contact me with a sort of mini petition or whatever saying we want to get this thing sorted, I will sort of lobby the council on their behalf and so on. Ranging from, you know, before we came into the studio, Martin was talking to me about the situation in Colombia and the human rights there. So there's a whole gamut of things. And, you know, in some cases it will just be people emailing their MP or signing up to online petitions or, you know, lobbying in that sort of way just to make sure their voices are heard. You know, I recommend that people take it a bit of a step further and actually join campaigns where they can really get immersed in a topic and, you know, either do some fundraising for it or, you know, go out and tell more people about what's going on. And
but if you MPs were doing your job properly, people wouldn't have to go joining campaigns, would they?
Well, you're being devil's advocate here, aren't you, Tony?
Just for change.
Yeah. But you know, there are always going to be things that need addressing. And, you know, when we've got a government where, you know, me and very many people living in my constituency would fundamentally disagree with the path they're taking, you know, there's obviously going to be a role for me to act as their advocate and to try to ameliorate the worst damage that they can cause.
Now, the Labour Party, your party, were running things up till May, and it was really a kind of new Labour style thing, which many people were saying was actually very similar to Thatcherism.
Yeah, well, I'd sort of totally disagree with that.
Privatising, for example, doing quite a lot of privatisations, and that seems to be the sort of, you know, right wing of the Labour Party.
No, well, there was, you know, we didn't have the old antipathy towards working with the private sector where it was important. And today, I actually went to visit a private sector training provider. So they're sort of providing training for apprentices and so on in the furniture industry that happened. And, you know, that was a classic example of an organisation that, yes, it might be private sector, it's got some public sector funding as well, but is doing a very good job and is providing a real service within Bristol that wasn't being met by the public sector. And I don't have an ideological objection to us working with the private sector in that way. I think it would be silly to do so. There's a big difference between that and having a sort of almost like a rabid fear of the public sector, which is what you have from the Conservatives at the moment, where anything that is public sector is bad. And we almost seem to have moved from the old Labour days when anything private sector was bad to now where you've got things like the Bonfire, the Quangos, where if anything is a public sector body, it seems to be singled out for, you know, for the acts, or assumed that it's wasting public money, assumed that it's not fulfilling a useful purpose. And that idea that, you know, when they rail against big government, there is very much this ideology that you should leave people to, you know, you should leave things to market forces, you should leave people to get on with their own lives, and the role of the state should be absolutely minimal, which, you know, I'd fundamentally disagree with. And I think if you look back, if you actually look at the criticisms that the current government is making of the last Labour government, it's that we were too interventionist, we spent too much public money, we believed in too big a role for the state. So that's very different to what they're offering.
But what about these things like the public-private partnerships? Because these seem to leave a great deal of debt for future generations. And although you get your hospital built, you get your school built or whatever, this is going to be much more costly than it would be in the long term because of, again, interest repayments.
Yeah. Well, with PFI, it's very much the sort of value of each PFI scheme is very much as good as the contract which underlies it. And in the early days of PFI, there were absolutely some appalling deals done where we were more or less giving money to private sector contractors hand over fist and requiring very little of them in return. I mean, when I say we, it was when it was first introduced under the Conservative government. Those were tightened up substantially. And actually, it's quite difficult to compare like for like, because under if you've got a private finance initiative contract to run a school, it's not just the same as getting somebody to build a school. There's ongoing obligations for about 30 years or so. But, you know, we couldn't have built, you know, we've rebuilt all the secondary schools in my constituency. Everywhere you go in Bristol, you can see the results of being able to front load that investment. And we wouldn't have been able to do that if we just relied on public spending.
Well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, our regular, is with me too. Martin, let's just look abroad a bit now. Now, the Japanese thought they'd come through the banking crisis back in the 1990s, but this week they've slashed their interest rates again to zero. So does that mean that their original attempt to sort out their banking crisis has failed?
Well, they never managed to sort it out. It's just been ongoing for over a decade. And the reduction of their interest rates is an attempt to manipulate their currency downwards and to help their exports. But everybody is now playing this game. We're on the brink, possibly, of a currency war. That's the sort of thing that's being talked about now.
Now, what would that actually mean for us here in Britain, then?
Well, it would mean that everybody is trying to basically export their way out of the crisis, but, of course, everybody can't export.
Well, we don't do a lot of exports from Britain anymore,
There are obviously structural problems as well, because countries like China dominate exports in the world now, and it's very difficult for anybody else to get into the game. But, I mean, the danger of a currency... Basically, countries using their currencies as a weapon. If everybody starts doing that, there could be a very nasty, you know, as happened in the 30s, basically people pursuing the beggar thy neighbour policies, which will bring the whole world economy to the brink of disaster, really.
The other economic questions that's been bugging me this week, we keep hearing about the massive billions of pounds of debt repayment that the British government is having to do at the moment. But why on earth are they paying these massive rates of interest when we hear that the Bank of England's rate of interest is virtually zero?
Well, what we're doing, effectively, is we are trying to resurrect the private banking system as it was before the crisis so that we can get back to normal. I think that's fundamentally misguided myself, but I think people will only recognise that once we've gone through another phase of crisis, and then people will realise that these conventional solutions, which are being offered, for example, by the current coalition, it's very much conventional 19th century textbook economics. We all know that if haven't got enough money, we've got to cut back. Well, actually, this is illiterate. I think that will only become apparent once the crisis intensifies, and then people will realise that the condemns basically don't know what they're doing.
Well, look, but if the Bank of England is lending money now at virtually zero interest, why can't the government just borrow a whole load of money at virtually zero interest from the Bank of England, and then we won't be having to service this massive debt with all these interest payments?
Well, this is the fundamental...
Is that simplistic of me to say that?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's more complicated than that. But at the same time, the fundamentals we've got to recognise is that the private banking system has collapsed. You can see what the present government are doing. It's Labour's profligacy which have got us into this.
Well, certainly
mess.
That's happened in Ireland, hasn't it?
Yeah,
because we've seen that the bailout hasn't worked in Ireland. They had to bail out again. What makes you think that the same is going to happen here?
Well, I think the Ireland is an extremely interesting case because of what's happened there. They have been cutting, the deficits got worse, and their credit ratings collapsed. And it's actually a road to nowhere. And I suspect that come the new year, or perhaps even before Christmas, people in Britain are going to realise that we're on the road to nowhere. House prices crashed in September by £6,000 per average house. So all of those middle-class people who voted Conservative in the hopes that they were going to have all lost £6,000 per head, as it were, just in 1 month. And just think how much you could lose in a year if it carried on in that kind of way. And the policy of cuts will be seen, I'm sure, to be wrong quite soon by the electorate. They're already dubious about it. And as it comes forward, people are going to realise that not only is this unfair, desperately unfair, it's just irrational and it won't work.
Now, Kerry, Martin's mentioned this story which has come out just yesterday about the UK house mm-hmm. prices, and Reuters are telling us that British house prices have plunged a record 3.6% on the month in September. Mortgage lender Halifax said yesterday, in a further sign the housing market is rapidly losing steam after a pickup last year. Analysts were cautious, apparently, about reading too much into 1 month's data, but noted the recent mortgage approvals data had also pointed to a weakening market and that fragile economic conditions meant the outlook was bleak. Now, what do you think of this? Is this really a significant plunge in house prices? And what does this tell us about the way the economy's going, the recovery?
I think it's a bit too soon to tell. I think if you look at the previous couple of months, house prices rose, although not very by no means as dramatically as they've now fallen. And I think we're still, house prices now are up a year ago. Obviously, people who bought their house at the absolute peak, you know, a few years ago, will be sort of feeling quite hard done by and be sort of worried about, you know, their own financial position. But I just think it's a bit too soon to predict. Overall, though, you know, I mean, certainly I'm very worried about whether we're going back into recession. I agree with what Martin was saying about, you know, the economic illiteracy of thinking that savage cuts are the way to go forward. If you look at the figures for the construction industry from the last quarter, the fact that Labour decided that, you know, one of the ways to ensure that we did move into economic recovery and avoided, you know, moving into depression was to invest in the construction industry, keep people building things and front load that spending. And that has paid off. You know, the construction industry had a very good quarter. It does worry me that, you know, the knock-on effects of all that's happening in terms of the government's very sort of drastic approach to the economy.
Okay, Martin, what do you think the implications of this are then, this house? I mean, I know you mentioned it just how do we know whether this is a beginning of a slide in house prices or whether it's just a blip?
Well, we don't, is the simple answer. It's only 1 month's figures, as Kerry just pointed out. But as it says here, Howard Archer, chief UK economist at IHS Global Insight, described the house price data as an absolute shocker. So it's a pretty worrying signal. Danny Blanchflower, who used to sit on the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, as soon as he saw the coalition's policy, said, "I'm not mostly economists." He said, Try not to be too definite because it's very hard to predict the future. But he said, I'm absolutely 100% certain there will be a double dip recession because of the policies that the coalition are suggesting. And Danny Blanchflower, as far as I'm concerned, called it right all the way.
Yeah.
All the way. So I'm inclined to believe him.
Yeah.
OK, well, it's been the week of the Conservative Party conference, and the leader, David Cameron, gave a sort of rousing speech. And in it, he talked about that your country needs you. So let's have a little listen now back to Birmingham and a few days ago with David Cameron's big conference speech.
Citizenship is not a transaction in which you put your taxes in and get your services out. It's a relationship. You're part of something bigger than yourself. It matters what you think and you feel and you do. So to get out of the mess that we're in, changing the government is not enough. We need to change the way we think about ourselves and our role in society. Your country needs you. And today, I want to tell you about the part we've all got to play and the spirit that will take us through. It's the spirit that I saw in a group of NHS maternity nurses in my own constituency, increasingly frustrated by the way they were managed and handled. They wanted to set up a co-op to use their expertise, their ideas, their contacts to provide a better service for the mums in the area. It's the spirit you see just down the road from this conference centre in Balsall Heath, where local residents were fed up with the pimps and the prostitutes and the gangs and the drug dealers. So they set up street patrols to clear them out of the area and turn what was a no-go zone into a desirable place to live.
Okay, that's David Cameron speaking earlier on this week at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. Well, first to you, Kerry. I don't imagine you were amazingly impressed by his speech, being from another party. But isn't he really there saying that this is a chance for everybody? This is why he's using this sort of imagery of your country needs you, everybody to start getting more involved in politics.
But it's just an excuse, really, isn't it, to dismantle government, dismantle the welfare state, and to more or less turn things around and say, well, it's up to you lot to look after yourself now. And that's partly driven by what they see as the financial need to make these cuts, but also by an ideological agenda, which is about, you know, reducing the role of government and leaving it all to market forces. And the picture that he paints of it was very much, actually, I mean, it's dressed up in different words with this whole big society ethos, but it's pretty much what Margaret Thatcher was saying in the 1980s, when you almost get to the position where you've got soup kitchens handing out welfare, and you've got people relying on charity, and you see it in some of the American states. If you look at the Wisconsin model of welfare reform, it's very much along those lines as well. And he's just dressing it up in slightly sort of cuddlier language, so it looks like everyone's all pulling together, and isn't it wonderful, and the British spirit and that. Whereas actually, it really is about sort of pulling up the drawbridge and say, well, it's everybody for themselves, and if you want to help your neighbour, then you get on with it.
But I mean, really, he's trying to encourage people to get involved in small business, isn't he? He's talking about the nurses setting up the co-ops, and isn't this surely a positive thing? That it's one of the ways that we're going to get out of recession as well, isn't it? But more small businesses getting going now.
Well, it depends how that's going to be funded. If the nurses are going to receive funding to set up a co-op, and actually, we've got the Bristol Birth Centre campaign, which is sort of along those lines, where it's a group of midwives that don't like the sort of, if you like, quite sterile and atmosphere and hospital wards, and think that sort of smaller community-based birth centres would provide a better service. So something like that would be great. But, are you going to use it as a backdoor excuse to cut NHS funding? Are you going to fund the new services, which actually could be more expensive if you're doing lots of little things rather than one big provider? It sounds nice, it sounds cuddly, but you have to actually look at where the money is and where the actual support is for these services, because they're not going to happen just by themselves.
Martin, what do you think of David Cameron, the Conservative leader there, using the imagery of the First World War and Kitchener?
Well, I think it's quite interesting, because Kitchener, of course, was a famous butcher and a failure. He's one of the famous donkeys that led the lions. So actually making it just shows a bit of historical illiteracy as well as economic illiteracy, doesn't it?
What about what he's actually saying, though, which is this whole, I suppose, he's talking really about this idea of the big society. And he's saying people themselves, individuals, should become politicised and get engaged.
I think that the Conservative Party, in my view, should have actually looked at its own history and looked back to the post-Second World War Conservative Party. People like Macmillan, people voted Conservative because they wanted a Conservative policy. That is to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That was always the great strength of the Conservative
Party. That's sort of Conservative with a small C.
Yes, but it was also the great strength of the British Conservative Party that it was pragmatic. Very pragmatic.
Isn't that sort of like the British establishment? It doesn't really like change very much.
Well, exactly. But I mean, British people don't like change. Not British people, but people in general like things to be the same. And that's the great appeal of conservatism as a philosophy, isn't it? Let's not rock the boat. Let's just take steady as she goes. No drastic manoeuvres.
But you're saying,
if I was David Cameron, I would be saying, we're not going to do anything drastic. We're pretty much going to carry on the same policy as the Labour government, but we're going to do very odd things slightly differently. But everything is safe in our hands, because we're not going to be ideological. We're going to be conservative, and we're not going to turn everything upside down. And Kerry mentioned Margaret Thatcher earlier. I suspect that the Conservative Party has become more ideological in the last 20 years, not less. Yeah. I mean, the scale of the cuts they're demanding is far greater than anything that Margaret Thatcher attempted to do, and the recession and depression and the dangers are even greater. But they don't seem to have taken on board that the free market philosophy has been blown out of the water intellectually. It's just gone. It's finished. The efficient market hypothesis, the Black-Scholes theorem, all of this stuff is just wrong. And the Conservative Party in the past, of the Conservative Party of the 50s, for example, built more council houses than any other government. And Macmillan, were he alive today, would be laughing at what they're proposing to do.
Anyway, let's have another listen now to the next part of David Cameron's speech earlier this week at the Birmingham Conservative Conference, where he explains a bit more about what he means by the spirit of "your country needs you."
It's the spirit that just today has seen some of our leading social organisations come together to set up a new citizens' university to help give people the skills they need to play a bigger part in our society. It's the spirit of activism, dynamism, people taking the initiative, working together to get things done. It's a spirit that has inspired this conference this week, as you've heard from teachers and councillors with a passion for what you do. Seeing our activists building community centres down the road in Alum Rock or on the other side of the world in Rwanda. It's the spirit of social responsibility that drives our party today. Now I accept, sometimes this spirit can get taken a little bit too far. I got a letter from a six-year-old girl called Neve with a pound coin stuck to it. And there was a note from her mum which said, "Dear Mr. Cameron, after hearing about the budget deficit, Neve wanted to send you her tooth fairy money to help out." There we are, George. Nearly there. Thank you, Neve. But what I'm talking about, the spirit that we need, is the big society spirit.
There we are, the big society spirit, explained by David Cameron at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham earlier this week. Now, Kerry, he's talking there about the things like the Citizens University, and he's also saying, explaining with that little letter, that you know many people really do want to help to plug the deficit, including kids with their tooth fairy money. But what about the broader idea there that he's talking about? We're not talking about children sending in a pound to help with the deficit. We're really talking about this whole idea of social responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he should have given the kid the money back and explained that he'd been scaremongering about the scale of the deficit and the need for so-called savage cuts. Because, yeah, I mean, certainly, yeah, my point of view, I agree with what Ed Ball said during the Labour leadership campaign, that, you know, it would actually be economically damaging to rush into cuts now, and even perhaps what we went into the election promising as a Labour Party, which was to halve the deficit in 4 years. You know, I think that what worries me is that that was a political stance, in that we thought it was needed to sort of give us economic credibility that we were serious about reducing the deficit. And I think actually it should be very much based on economic analysis as to what's best for the economy. And you know, I don't know whether people have heard Ed Ball's Bloomberg speech where he set out some of the thinking behind this, but you know, that's very much where I'm coming from, that now is not the time to cut. But on the wider thing, you know, yes, social responsibility is obviously a good thing, and people, you know, but the difficulty, I mean, it's something that Labour has always talked about. You know, Tony Blair's agenda was always very much about rights balanced with responsibilities. What worries me, though, is once you start talking about the issue of responsibility, it's very easy to find examples of people who are irresponsible and use them, and by highlighting that, you know, you will find a feckless father who has, you know, had 10 children by 10 different women, and you know, they're getting thousands of pounds worth in benefits and etc., etc. You will find those examples. And the classic thing actually is when George Osborne stood up during his budget and talked about people that were getting over 100,000 a year, I think, in housing benefit. And when the Treasury were actually asked how many people fall into this category, the Treasury press officer turned around and said, "Well, we don't actually have figures, but if you look at the Daily Mail or the Sun's website, you'll find plenty of stories." And that is government policy that is actually going to bring in fairly swingeing cuts to housing benefits that mean that people in central London, for example, will have to move out. You know, they will be homeless. They will not be able to live where they currently live in London. And that is on the basis of finding one or two examples of people, you know, this so, you know, the idea of the undeserving poor, and using it to actually scapegoat everybody and to cut, you know, and bring in things that really affect people across the board who are trying their best and struggling to get by.
But Mr Cameron is really serious, it seems, about this whole concept of social responsibility. He wants people to get engaged. That's what he was saying in his speech.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have a problem with when he talks about, you know, the idea of citizenship. I think he was talking about the idea of international service, you know, sending young people overseas to sort of work on development projects or whatever. You know, I think that may well be a good opportunity for them. And, you know, but you just have to look at what they're... If you look at what Margaret Thatcher did in terms of actually destroying a sense of society amongst people, and that selfish individualism, and the fact that, you know, the idea that it was every man or woman for themselves, that is what's underlying the politics of what's going on now. So to sort of try to bundle that up with this idea that, you know, social responsibility and we're all in this together, the two things just don't gel.
Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, what were your thoughts there about what he's talking about, David Cameron, at the Conservative Party conference earlier this week, the Citizens University, for example? I mean, he's coming up with all sorts of initiatives, isn't he, to try and get people engaged in politics.
Well, I think he's going to get people engaged in politics, but not in a way he's going to like. Because, of course, you do have a right to protest against government policies in this country. It's a very hard-won right, and that's what the First World War and the Second World War were arguably about. And I think, as we've seen in France, as we've seen in other European countries, we've got to change the policy at the top. There's going to have to be a big shake-up, and it's going to... We're talking about the undeserving poor. What about the undeserving rich? What about the 1% of people in Britain who control 50% of the wealth? That we've got a completely unequal society. It's got more unequal as capitalism has been allowed to run its course.
Yes, under your party, the Labour Party.
I totally understand that in many ways, New Labour's half-hearted approach to reforming capitalism has opened the door to this basically silly approach. I mean, it really is believing in the tooth fairy, isn't it? The tooth fairy is going to rescue the economy. That's what it boils down to. And it's absolutely wrong. I think what's happened in the Labour leadership campaign is that we as a party have started to have a proper debate about the economy. So I very much welcome Ed Balls's remarks about perhaps we should be building more council houses. Hey, we weren't saying that when we were in power. Rather than cutting, we should be investing for the future.
Isn't that shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted?
Well, no, but
they're out of power.
That's what
now
happened. I mean, inevitably, mistakes were made when Labour was in power. I mean, governments in power do, you know, they have to work within the constraints that they feel are on them. So, for example, in the election campaign, we were saying that we would cut, but not as fast as the Tories. I personally think that we should have said, we've got to cut the deficit, but we don't have to cut public expenditure. We've got to increase public expenditure in order to break...
Well, how on earth can you do that? You can't spend and save at the same time.
Oh, yes, you can. Yeah. We did it in the 1930s and we did it in the 1940s and we did it in the 1950s. It's perfectly straightforward. But you have to actually cover the deficit by saying, well, some people have done very well out of the last generation. They will have to pay.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about the ratio between spending cuts and tax receipts. And if you have a go-for-growth policy, which is what Ed Balls and some others have been advocating, you know, tax receipts will rise. If you have these spending cuts that are brought in now, and for example, you know, what I said earlier about the construction industry, if you're laying off builders and all the people that would work on construction projects left, right and centre, your tax receipts are going to absolutely plummet. And, you know, then you get into a spiral when more spending cuts will be needed because, you know, the money's not coming in.
But surely if you're trying to tax the rich, I mean, let's look at Bristol as a sort of little microcosm of the country. Stephen Lansdowne is a very wealthy Bristol citizen, has decided to go off to the Channel Islands. Isn't that just what's going to happen? Is that the people are going to take their wealth out of the country if you try and tax them?
Well, I don't think it was Stephen Lansdowne himself, but somebody from his firm took part in a television show with me a few weeks ago when he was advocating axing all public sector pensions. He didn't think that we should fund it. You know, why should people in the public sector get their pensions paid for by the taxpayer, et cetera, et cetera? And this was somebody, you know, I gather the firm's got about 20 millionaires that have made money by selling private sector pensions to people in the private sector, which presumably they would be getting slightly better pensions if the partners weren't becoming millionaires on the back of it. But, you know, we left this show where this guy basically argued that people are in receipt of, you know, the average public sector pensions between about £4,000 and £7,000 a year. It's not a lot of money. And he was saying, oh, scrap all these pensions. And he said, starting with MPs' pensions. I drove off in my little smart car Roadster, which is worth about £4,000, and he drove off in his Porsche, which I then looked up and turns out it's worth about £80,000. So, you know, I don't have a great deal of sympathy for him if people like that think that they're being priced out of the country, because I think they're doing incredibly well out of this country. And, you know, the fact that they're, you know, throwing a bit of a tantrum because they're being asked to contribute a little bit more is, you know, not something that evokes a great deal of sympathy from me.
A previous generation of Conservative politicians, and I include in this Edward Heath and Macmillan, would have been absolutely astonished with this kind of argument. During the Korean War in the 50s, the people were dying on the front line to preserve freedom, supposedly, but the top rate of tax on people like Mr. Hargreaves was 96%. And at the end of the Second World War, there was an understanding that we have a free economy and a free society, and you're allowed to set up your own businesses and make yourself rich, but that's always conditional on the fact that the economy as a whole is running for the benefit of the whole country. And some people pay with money and some people pay with blood. And at the end of the day, freedom and living in a free society is worth paying for. And if Mr. Hargreaves or any of these other people don't want to live in our free society and go away, they can go away, but they won't come back, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, one of the other big stories this week, or in fact today, is Ed Miliband announcing his new shadow cabinet. Now, can I ask you first, Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for Bristol East, what do you think about Ed Miliband as your new Labour leader?
Well, I think he's a bit... he's a bit of an unknown
quantity.
Did you
vote for him?
No, I voted for Ed Balls, and partly because some of the reasons that we've discussed is that I very much liked what he was saying on the economic front, and I'd worked with him on child poverty issues and within the Department for Children, Schools and Families as well, and I actually liked what he was saying on immigration, which got slightly twisted and it was seen that he was being, you know, quite... Some people thought he was playing the race card, but actually, or playing the immigration card, but actually what he was saying was a lot more subtle than that. So, you know, I supported Ed Balls. To be honest, you know, although I was elected the same time as Ed Miliband, I don't know him that well, and I think whereas with Ed Balls or David Miliband or even Andy Burnham to an extent, I would have known what I was getting. With Ed Miliband, I think he's a bit more of an unknown quantity, and we'll have to see how he shapes up. He's got quite a tough job on his hands, but, you know, he's somebody of ability. Whenever I've seen him, you know, perform in Parliament or whatever, or whenever I've had private conversations with him, I've been impressed by his intellectual ability and by, you know, his sincerity. Full of hope for him, but I just, you know, we've got to see how it pans out.
Now, you were a whip when the Labour were in government before May, but I don't see, I'm just flicking through the names of Ed Miliband's cabinet, I don't see you down there, Kerry.
No, I didn't run for the shadow cabinet. I was one of at one stage it felt like everybody in the parliamentary Labour Party except me were running for the shadow cabinet, and I had to sort of, you know, switch my phone off for the best part of a fortnight because they all wanted my vote, but no, I think about 49 people ran for it in the end, and we've now had 19 people elected, and he's announced the post today.
Now, the key person amongst all that, at least, you know, I would imagine many people think so, what with the economic crisis, is the Shadow Chancellor, who we've heard today is going to be Alan Johnson. What do you think of his abilities as a Chancellor?
Yeah, I'm slightly surprised by his appointment because... Yeah, it wouldn't come as no surprise to think that, you know, I would have liked to see Ed Balls get the job, seen as I very much support what he's been saying about the economy. And Yvette Cooper, who topped the shadow cabinet poll, would have been another good choice. She's got an economics background too. Or even John Healey, who actually came top out the men. And he's a bit, you know, he's not somebody that most people know, but actually very popular within the Parliamentary Labour Party and was a Treasury Minister for a very long time. I think with Alan, actually, in terms of, you know, it remains to be seen what his particular stance is on some of the economic issues. And he's really got to get up to speed very quickly because we've got the comprehensive spending review on October the 20th. So that's going to be a mammoth task for him to get his head around that. Although he's got Angela Eagle now as his Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and she's very experienced on financial issues. But I think with perhaps the masterstroke, though, with Alan Johnson is once you start to imagine him going head to head against George Osborne in the Commons. So you've got George Osborne with his trust fund and, you know, his public school background and that against the guy who left school at 15 and lived in a tower block and was a postman. You know, perhaps that, you know, in terms of signalling, you know, somebody who understands really what it's like for people who are, you know, the impact on somebody of maybe just taking £5 a week away from them, how significant that can be. You know, I think certainly in terms of, you know, communicating the differences between the two parties, Alan's a good person to do that.
Martin, what are your thoughts then on the new shadow cabinet that Ed Miliband has announced today?
Yeah, well, I only heard about who got what earlier this afternoon from Kerry. I'm a bit surprised that Alan Johnson was shadow chancellor. I would have thought it would have been Ed Balls or Yvette Cooper. I think he's a safe pair of hands. I don't think he's going to do anything dramatically wrong.
But doesn't that mean he'll just do what he's told? Well, when you say a safe pair of hands.
Well, who's going to tell him? I mean, you know, there's going to be...
Ed is going to tell him.
No, there's going to be cabinet government. Clearly, because Ed was an outsider candidate to be the leader. I mean, I did vote for him, so I'm quite happy that he's won. But I mean, at the same time, he's got to build an alliance across the whole of the party. So he's going to have to be a collegiate leader as well. You know, he's not just going to be able to give orders. And I think that's all to the good, because we need to have a proper debate about the direction we need to go in. And I think what the leadership campaign did for me is that the economic debate moved on. So instead of talking about doing cuts slower than the Tories, which of course we all agreed on, we had Andy Burnham, for example, saying, well, perhaps we're going to have to look at the taxation system and bring in land value taxation. People talk about how do we get the money off wealthy people if they're going to run away to Guernsey or whatever. If you tax property, property can't run away. When I used to I went to Russia years ago when I was working for the New Economics Foundation and talked to economists about reforming the former Soviet economy, and they had a problem. How do we get the taxes off the new wealthy classes? Because they've got all of these hidey holes where they can hide their money and they take it abroad, and we just can't get it. And the answer, of course, is you tax property, because property can't run away. And if people don't pay the money they owe on a property, you simply impound it. Yeah. Now, what's happened is that the tax system over a generation has been undermined by basically being cut. We haven't got resources to do the things we want to do because the taxes that used to exist at the end of the Second World War, which gave us the resources, have all been taken away. So we've got a much lower tax economy than we had in those eras. Now, actually, a high tax economy on wealthy people is an efficient way to run the economy. They don't like it. Of course they don't. But that's the efficient way to do it. And basically, you should treat wealthy people as you treat people at the bottom end of the spectrum. You don't overpay them. You don't overpay cleaners. You don't overpay dustbin collectors. And you don't overpay people running the banks either, because it's not efficient.
Okay, the cuts, it seems, are hitting us now in Bristol, starting to roll down. And yesterday's Bristol Evening Post had the headline, Bristol City Council reveals £22 million worth of cuts. The biggest ever council cuts have been unveiled, according to the Evening Post, with a promise to protect frontline services. But the sheer scale of the cuts means it's inevitable that the young, the elderly and the sick will be affected. Council yesterday announced £22 million will be slashed from budgets next year in order to balance the civic books. And there will be a total reduction of £50 million by March 2014, which are the biggest cuts in the council's history. Next year's cuts will mean a loss of 700 council jobs, with 400 already gone. Although few, if any, are expected to be as a result of compulsory redundancy. Council employs about 9,000 full-time staff, but this does not include those who work in schools. Now, Kerry, how do you think this is going to go down in the politics of the City Council? Obviously, you know quite a few people there too. I mean, how are these cuts actually going to affect Bristol City as a whole?
Well, I think we need to see more detail about how they plan to actually, you know, implement these cuts. It's all very well to talk about efficiency savings, but, you know, the experience of central government teaches us there are never quite as many efficiency savings to be found as politicians like to dream up and announce that there are to be found.
Well, there seems to be a bit of a contradiction here, because we're hearing that that there's a promise to protect frontline services, and yet... Actually, I'm just doing my maths here. 1,100 jobs are going really within the first year. And how is that? Is that actually possible to protect frontline services when you're getting rid of 1,100 people out of a total of 9,000?
Well, again, you get back to this myth that local government or government, any sort of public sector organisation, is absolutely full of bureaucrats that just sit around ticking boxes and aren't actually doing useful work. And I've met... quite a lot with people working in the public sector since the election, for example, people at Job Centre Plus. And that wouldn't be seen as a frontline service, but actually, you know, so it's like, well, we're getting rid of these faceless bureaucrats there. But actually, if their numbers are being cut, that is having a direct impact on people receiving their benefits or being given the support they need, say if they're people with disabilities that need a bit of extra support to get into work. And there are so many organisations that you wouldn't necessarily see as the front line. I met with Terence Higgins Trust the other day. And again, you know, providing face-to-face advice, support, counselling, and advice that actually moves people on from one place to another and really helps them. Is that class, you know, if that's just a council grant going to that organisation, it probably wouldn't deem to be a council frontline service, but actually it's really crucial that they carry on doing their work.
But
and that's what worries me, is that by cutting staff that sit at a desk at a computer, they will say, well, that's not frontline because you're not actually going out touching another member of the public. But, you know, it all links up and it's all important.
But don't you think actually the council's really got to do this? Otherwise there's going to be an increase in council tax, and surely people just can't afford to pay that.
Well, it's partly because the government has sort of put a de facto freeze on council tax for the next couple of years that the council's in this position. Of course, you've got to balance what people can afford to pay and what services are provided. And, you know, there is scope for making some cuts. But, you know, these things are interwoven. So, as I said, you know, if you've got programmes that help people get back into work and support them, perhaps, you know, public health programmes that are stopping people needing to rely on the NHS, at the end of the day, you know, it might be a short-term saving, but at the end of the day, it could well have a longer-term cost. And those are the things you have to take a sensible, pragmatic approach to it.
Well, I have to say that, well, I don't have to say anything, but I will. the Conservatives' deputy leader on Bristol City Council, Peter Abraham, said major surgery was needed to make the cuts that were necessary. But he also said, I cannot see how frontline services will not be affected. Martin, how do you think this is going to affect the city over the next year or so?
Well, it's just on a basic level, it's taking demand out of the local economy, isn't it? And that's most likely to, once you've got rid of 1,500 public sector workers, those
well,
people...
Well, it's actually 1,100.
All right, 1,100.
In the first year.
Well, there will be a knock-on effect in the private sector. And this is the fallacy behind the whole policy that's being pursued. I mean, most economists that have looked at the figures suggest that there will be more job losses in the private sector as a result of the Condemn policy than in the public sector.
But Martin, there simply isn't the money to pay these people.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. I mean, we mentioned council tax a minute ago. Council tax, of course, was never brought in, or poll tax in Northern Ireland. They still have the rates which were brought in originally under Queen Elizabeth I, because they were a most efficient way of getting the wealthy classes to pay for the services that the whole society needed. Andy Burnham in the election campaign was talking about land value taxation. I used to work for Bristol Debt Advice Centre a couple of years ago, and I was developing a paper for them about why council tax was not the efficient way to raise funds for local government. It's actually son of poll tax. It's regressive, that is to say it falls more heavily on poor people, it creates benefit traps, so as soon as you go into work, I got into work and immediately I was actually worse off because I was stung for council tax, 100% council tax. Now, what's happened over a generation is that sensible taxation policy has been undermined by lobbying by the wealthy classes. And in terms of something like Bristol, we're talking about people in Clifton paying a lot less than they used to do under the old regime. The old regime brought in from, say, 1945 onwards. Now, basically, the top 5%, say, in British society in terms of wealth have done very, very well out of the last generation. Very well. And we're now in a big mess. It's a national emergency, as David likes to tell us, David Cameron. If it's a national emergency, it's time for the wealthy classes to get up on deck and present their checkbooks. And some mechanism has got to be found to make them pay their way. They won't like it. They never do. That's why they have the Conservative Party, to protect their interests. That's why we have the Labour Party, to protect ours.
Thank you, Martin. Well, we also have, a couple of weeks ago, we heard here that the plans are resuming again for a biofuel power plant down at Avonmouth. That is a plant that works, generates electricity by palm oil shipped in from abroad. So we thought we'd go out onto the streets of Bristol and ask you what you think about climate change.
Climate change, does it exist? And if so, what are the main effects?
Yes, rising sea levels, increased temperatures, decreased temperatures in warmer areas.
Destruction of land.
Desertification. Whether it affects my lifestyle directly, could make things more expensive living in the West. It'll increase land pressure as people want to move west. Food will be more scarce. Food growing areas will become more difficult as well.
course it does, yeah. The British weather changing. Summer seems to have moved, everything seems to shift a few, sort of like a couple of months. That's something that I notice. So weather conditions, ice caps are melting, seas are getting higher, things like that. You know, if we don't do something about it now, then not necessarily me, but it could be like my children or future generations that are going to suffer for it.
I don't think it does. I think it's been like historically, it's just gone sort of up and down, temperatures and the weather. So I think it just goes in cycles. I don't think there's really anything you can do to sort of fend it off, really.
We're certainly damaging the atmosphere, but I don't think it's to the extent that people are saying.
Certain times of the year are getting warmer quicker and it's getting darker earlier. Temperatures are all skew-whiff, sort of, because if you think about it, it used to be winter was cold, summer was hot, and now it seems to have switched. Summer is often really wintry and winter's often quite summery. But that's my experience. You know, in Iceland and all the cold countries, the ice is melting and all the animals, you know, they don't have homes anymore because the ice is melting, so they're having to either migrate or they die. And as an animal lover, I think there should be concern about it, yeah.
I think it's important to be conscious of our planet and the big quantity of resources that we are using right now. We should be more sensitive with this problem. Maybe climate change doesn't exist, but we should make the most of this opportunity to change our minds.
What is causing climate change and how does it affect our future?
Everyone is in the modern lifestyle that we lead. It's difficult to answer, but I think in every way it will impact on our future.
Everybody's responsible, so I don't think anybody can say that they're not responsible for it, because we all are.
I don't know what's causing it, but I think it's just general weather conditions that happen. Like I said, I think it comes in cycles. Probably 500 years ago they used to have all the floods and different things like that, and I think it's just come around to another cycle. I don't think it will impact my future here.
It might not affect our future as such, but it would affect like our family's future. Like, well, if, you know, me and my friend grow up and have children, then it will obviously affect them, because England won't actually be like England, because it would be like a completely different country, the climate and stuff. And, you know, it could easily, in a few years' time, we could easily all just be underwater, or other countries could just be underwater because obviously the ice caps are melting.
What can we do about it?
Just take a more logical approach to the way we live. We just need to live, don't live beyond our means, don't be so materialistic in our lifestyle, and that's it really. It's not a big change, it's very easy.
Things like recycling, that can help global warming. That's a big one, and that's something that's fairly simple that everybody can do. I think the government needs to do more about it rather than just chucking money at it and just thinking it's a problem that's going to go away. They need to deal with it.
I don't know who to believe. You know, somebody has it right, but I don't know who is right, and I don't think anybody knows who is right, so I'm not quite sure what we can do. But we can be more careful, more considerate, treat things better, look after the waste. You know.
There has to be more knowledge on the subject so that people, you know, conserve energy. There's all these just simple things, like they say, like turn off your telly before you go to bed at night, or turn everything off at the power switch, the mains, and all these like fossil fuels. We don't need fossil fuels because we have solar energy, like you know, wind turbines and stuff, so we don't actually need to burn fossil fuels anymore. It's actually been like scientifically proven that you don't need fossil fuels for anything except for like very, you know, certain things, but for the mass majority of things you don't need fossil fuels.
Simply consume less, use only what we need. I think that's the most important. I think it's up to everyone.
Thank you very much to Maria Morris, and she was out there asking you what you think about fossil fuels and climate change. Now, Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for Bristol East, is with me. Kerry, do you think that you made a good start in dealing with issues to do with climate change when you were in power as the Labour government before May?
Well, we had things like the climate change levy, the first ever climate change bill. We're the first country to introduce a bill like that. Progress being made on things like emissions trading, which I think the new government is backsliding on. If you look back, say 10 years, the agenda has changed absolutely dramatically. The problem that we always had was that these are the sort of things that can't be done by diktat by one government. There has to be international agreement, particularly when you look at things like aviation and when you look at the role of the United States. And, you know, I don't have the stats at my fingertips, but the levels of consumption in the United States compared to other countries means that you just can't tackle the problem at all unless you get the Americans on board. So it's partly about winning hearts and minds and winning the political argument on the international level. And I think there's more that we could do. But it is, you know, in terms of looking at the progress that was made since, say, 1997, we have come a long way.
But don't you think that really it's just the big multinationals that call the shots on this policy? And it's very difficult for governments to really do much about them. They're so big. People, the companies like BP, Shell, these kind of people, how can you tell them what to do?
Well, I mean, you have things like the renewable fuels obligation, which is saying that 20% of fuels have got to come from renewable sources. Things like the climate change levy, which actually puts a tax on business if they... if they're polluting, if their emissions are out of control. And also, so you've got some of the things which are a bit, like the stick, if you like, and then you've got other things which are like the carrot, where actually it becomes, with things like emissions trading, where it might make it economically, commercially advantageous for people to reduce their emissions. I do think, consumer pressure is something that will be, it's probably less important when you're going through difficult economic times because people can't, use their wallet, their power at the tills or whatever in quite the same way. But, I think certainly I get lobbied quite a lot by constituents who are complaining about the level of packaging on food, things like food miles they're concerned about. There's a bill that's coming through Parliament soon, a private member's bill, about it's the Sustainable Livestock Bill, which is very much about the impact of the livestock sector on the environment. So people are becoming aware about that, and that's based on a Friends of the Earth campaign called Fix the Food Chain, which I'm very supportive of. So there's quite a lot that's happening. There's a lot that's in the pipeline, but a lot more to do.
What about this biofuel plant, though, at Avonmouth? Because we're being told that this is great because it's using a fuel which is not a fossil fuel. It's a renewable energy. It's palm oil being imported from abroad. But then we're told, actually, it's the growing of this palm oil, the plants, is actually kicking people off the land abroad, somewhere where we don't see that here. So what are your thoughts about that sort of alternative?
And again, I mean, this is something that, you've got campaigns like Save the Orangutans that are involved in this because it's destroying their natural habitat in some place. So I've met with a farmer from the, he's a priest and a farmer from the Central American rainforest, as Friends of the Earth brought him over to Parliament to talk about their food chain campaign. And deforestation is a huge issue, particularly deforestation so that cattle feed can be grown. And, one of the things that I think we need to look at, and it's something I discussed with Ed Miliband and we were making progress on, was the council can't object to the plant being built on, it can do it on local environmental grounds, like whether it causes local pollution or noise or whatever. It can't object to it on the grounds that it thinks it's environmentally damaging on a bigger scale. And I think we ought to be able to sort of bring in those ethical issues when it comes to looking at planning applications.
What about you, Martin? What are your views about climate change and use or otherwise of fossil fuels?
I'm not a great fan of emissions trading, I have to say, and nor are Friends of the Earth, I believe, when they went to Copenhagen saying that we're not really interested in emissions trading. The reason I'm not very a big fan of emissions trading is it's another potential bubble for people to play silly games with. I think if you've got to actually look at this. In World War II, Britain basically did have a plan for how much coal it was going to dig and how much oil it was going to bring in to fight the war and so on. If you're going to tackle something like climate change, you need to think big in that kind of way. You need to decide where you want to go, how you're going to get there, and draw up a plan to go from A to B. And the market will not always be the way to do that. You may have to just decide that you're going to have I'm making the case here for economic planning. We've not really had that case made properly for a generation. I think having a plan is absolutely essential. Even if the plan's wrong, you can modify it and change it as you go forward. But having no plan is just not a serious option.
Well, we've got about a minute or so to go before the 6 o'clock news. And so I'll ask you first, Kerry. We had the sad death of British comedian Norman Wisdom this week. And Quentin Letts had a rather wonderful piece in the Daily Mail bemoaning the death of British comedy. Do you think British comedy is still alive and kicking or not?
Yeah, I think it's actually going through quite a good phase. I mean, again, you know, to mention the Friends of the Earth Fix the Food Chain campaign, they had a comedy night at a theatre in London where they had all sorts of people, actually quite a few of them with Bristol connections, people like Stephen Merchant and Mark Watson and that were involved, and Chris Addison, who's playing at the Tobacco Factory soon, but I think it's sold out. Yeah, people like that are really good coming through. So,
I think
yeah.
He's talking about the television comedy. Martin, oh, the final word from you.
Well, Norman Wisdom was very, very famous in Albania. And I remember I went to Albania when I was working for CAFOD. And when Norman came to visit, the whole country just dropped everything and went to the airport to see Norman. And he was a great advert for British society. The little guy fights back against impossible odds.
OK, well, that's now we're coming up to the time for the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest. That's Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy. After the news, now, if the recession makes you a squatter in your own home, if the mortgage company tells you to get out, what are your rights? And if the money dries up, how do you feed your family? Ben Ritchie from Bristol's squatter network BAM and Paul Hazelden from the Wild Goose Free Cafe, which looks after literally hundreds of homeless people every week on City Road in St Paul's, are here to tell it as it is. So please do join us after the news.
You are listening on BCFM. 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol